Welcome, g'day, and this is our podcast, Two Rabbis and a Podcast. I am Rabbi Mordechai Becher.
And I'm Yehoshua Karsh.
And if you listen to our first podcast, which was an introduction, you'd know virtually everything about us.
There's nothing left out, as far as I know.
Almost nothing. It's like a complete biography, autobiography.
Except.
Yes.
Except I did listen to it, trying to, you know, hear it from the outsider's point of view, somebody listening in. And I did recognize that I left something out in my own biography. And I want to say that...
Let's keep it clean.
Okay. I will. I'm going to try not to... I'm not including everything here, not including everything.
Okay, excellent.
But I thought about it deeply. Why did I leave it out? And I think I know. So you, when you explained who you were and where you're from, you mentioned that you're originally from Melbourne, Australia. And I did not mention where I'm originally from. I realized I just said I'm from Northbrook. And then I thought about that and I realized that this is not just something. This is it's a deep thing. And I wanted to, you know, discuss it with you. And that is that, let me ask you this question. What do Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Rabbi Akiva Tatz, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of blessed memory, and Yibodeh L'chaim, Rabbi Akiva Tatz, and you have in common? So before you even answer that, because you could think about it for a second. Before you answer it, though, I'm going to tell you. You all have accents that Americans find interesting. And honestly, if you saw somebody walking out of a lecture from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of blessed memory, and you asked them, what did he say? They have no idea. They have not a clue. Their eyes were batting. They were sighing throughout the whole thing because he has an accent. Some people will say he's brilliant. How would they know if he's brilliant? They don't listen to the content. They only listen to the accent. It's the same thing with Rabbi Tatz. Do I know if he's brilliant or he's not brilliant? I happen to have had conversations with him where I was trying to ignore the accent, but it's very hard to ignore the accent. I have no idea what's back there. It's just, as far as I'm concerned, and I'll be honest with you, it's pretty much the same with you too. The accent, for some reason, Americans are so attracted to accents. And it's not like Milwaukee doesn't have an accent, but the accent police have considered it uninteresting.
Well, I would disagree. I mean, I agree that...
In principle.
I agree in principle that people, as Americans, very often are fascinated by a Commonwealth accent. In the case of Rabbi Sacks, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, English. In the case of Akiva Tatz, Yibodeh L'chaim Tovim, it's South African. And in my case, Yibodeh L'chaim Tovim, can I say that about myself, I guess?
Yes.
Australian.
Yes.
But people do remember the content. People do listen.
I don't think so.
In my experience.
I don't think so.
In
they have no idea.
People,
honestly, they have no idea.
I don't.
There anything behind you? They don't know. They don't know. What is it? If I talk to somebody who came out of one of your lectures, they have this, he's my hero. That honestly, I heard somebody told me that like 2-3 weeks ago. Somebody who you were on a podcast with, she told me that she was interviewing one of her all-time heroes when she was interviewing you. She has no idea what you're saying, honestly, Mordechai.
People have said
even your own parents probably, after you were about 10, could not tell if you were saying anything of kind. All they're doing is listening to your accent.
Well, first of all, my mother, Aleha HaShalom, had an English accent.
Oh, now that's a higher, in the
my
higher.
My father field. Was from Poland, and spoke Australian with a Polish accented Australian. But I do disagree. I think people do listen and get something out of the lecture.
Maybe
I think
it creeps through.
I think you're exaggerating.
Bit.
I think the
it might creep.
You are from Wisconsin.
I am from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I am proud of it.
Okay.
I am proud of it. But for some reason,
okay,
the accent police have determined that an accent from Wisconsin is not exotic. It's not interesting. One time I was applying for a job at a seminary and I had to give a sample course, a sample class to a group of the students there. And I worked hard to make sure it was good. And I gave it, I was proud of it. And then a hand went up and I asked, yes, expecting a question about the content. And they asked, where are you from? Now, almost everybody at this seminary were from New York. And she said, where are you from? And I didn't even at first know what she's asking. And she goes, where are you from? I said, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And she was no longer interested. It was the accent, but once I said Milwaukee, there was like crickets and nobody, there was no follow-up. What's it like to live in Milwaukee? Nothing like that. There was nothing.
I don't know. I think you're putting too much weight on the accent.
There's the guy with the accent.
If I was from Wisconsin, I'd probably
that do was it. Like if you were a billionaire, you'd say money means nothing. That's the same thing. That's your way of fine. I get it. You've got it. You've got what people dream of. Fine.
Okay. All right. Well.
Okay. So.
Okay. Thank
our
God.
Topic for today.
That I have an Australian accent. Okay. And the topic for today, we decided to talk about music, from a Torah or a Jewish perspective on music. Before we start, a member of Nachman Bulman, Alav Hashalom, very, very brilliant, brilliant Torah scholar, very sensitive, amazing person who taught at Or Sameach when we both taught there in Israel. And I remember he told me he once was asked to speak about suffering at some venue in New York. And he told them he would give a Jewish perspective on suffering. When he got there, the poster said, the Jewish perspective on suffering. And he was extremely upset and spent, I think, the first 15 minutes of the lecture talking about how there were numerous Jewish perspectives on suffering. He did not have the arrogance to say that he's giving the Jewish perspective on suffering. He's giving a Jewish perspective on suffering. And so when we say we're giving a Jewish perspective on music, it is our understanding of Torah's perspective on it, and it's with that caveat. I mean, I assume people realize that, but there are many who purport to present and represent the Jewish understanding of some idea. While there are certainly parameters, and there are certainly extremes where I won't go, and that's not Jewish and that, etc., but within... You know, within there is room for discussion and there's room for argument. I remember Rabbi David Gottlieb once pointing out to someone who there was some definition the guy wasn't sure of. He said, everyone agrees that Everest, Mount Everest, Kilimanjaro, Mount Fuji, they're mountains. And everyone would agree that the hill on Park Avenue, right, is a hill. And in between, so he says, we can still talk about mountains and hills. In the middle, between those two, there are things which are debatable, which is fine. But there are parameters. Okay. In any case, having said that, this is not the Jewish view of music. This is our understanding to some degree of music. So, first of all, music gets mentioned all the way back in Genesis, Bereshis, right? In Bereshis, for Genesis 4, we are told that there was someone called Yuval, who was the father of all those who would play the harp and the organ, a string instrument and a wind instrument. That'd be interesting. All the way back, when it talks about the creation of agricultural machinery and agriculture and cities and iron and stuff. So one of the significant creations, inventions, innovations of a human being, of the humans, was this idea of instruments, musical instruments. It's like fascinating, all the way back, Bereshis 4. Later on in the Torah, numerous times, songs are spoken about. The most famous, which we're going to read spoiler alert, in 2 weeks' time, we'll be reading this in the Chumash, right, which is the song of the Red Sea. Later on, so the Jews sing a song at the Red Sea. Then a little afterwards, we are told that Miriam took out her instruments. They had various musical instruments. She and the women danced and sang at the crossing of the Red Sea as well. Later on, in the book of Numbers 21, we have the song at the well. Jews have this miraculous well providing them with water in the desert, and they sing a song as well. So there's a lot of songs out there, a lot of music out there. We know, and we discussed this already, that in the temple in Jerusalem, the Levites, I'm a Levi, by the way, so
He takes this very, very seriously and very personally. For any of you who'd like to see a sample of what it's going to sound like in the Beis HaMikdash, when the Levim get back together and sing again, there's a YouTube video of the Levitical choir. The Temple Institute assembled a Levitical choir. For some reason, did not call Mordechai to be part of it, but there's a sample of what it might sound like if you're a Levi.
I certainly hope it sounds better than that, because I think if people play that, they'll stop praying for Messiah, for the Mashiach. I really do not want to, you know. I remember there was a wine someone brought, Rav Moshe Rom, who was a Zecher Tzadik Livracha, one of our Rebbeim, he was a Shiver at Mishkan, wonderful. Yes. I had a great close relationship with him, Rav Moshe Rom. And he was from, I think originally from Belgium, and he was a refined person.
Very dignified. Very dignified.
Dignified, refined. And one of the guys came to his house. I was with him for Shabbos, and the guy brought him some wine, which was called Yayin Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden wine. And it was one of these, like, sickly sweet that you have to spoon out of the bottle, you know. It'll kill diabetes at sight, diabetics at
you
sight.
You could use it on pancakes. It's good to serve
unbelievable. For pancakes. Yes. And I remember him commenting to me, he says, I do hope that Gan Eden is significantly better than this wine. So anyway, I do hope that the songs in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash, will be significantly better.
It's what we have right now. That's all I
YouTube
know.
YouTube video, okay. But anyway, the Talmud says, based on verses in the Torah, in Bamidbar and also in Divrei HaYomim, in Chronicles and in Numbers, the Talmud says in Arachin that one of the services of the Levites in the temple was actually avodah, which means a service or a worship almost. We sometimes translate that as worship, was to sing. There was a Levite choir and there was a Levite orchestra. And they would stand on the steps, they would sing. There were special songs for every day of the week, which we still say every day, a different song for that day. These are the songs that the Levites would sing in the temple. I remember Rav Moshe Shapiro once saying, he says, the first time most people have any type of actual rational thought during prayers in the morning is when they get to Hayom Yom. Today is it Monday? Hoping, praying that it's not Wednesday, because that's the longest, and praying that it's either Tuesday or Thursday, whatever, you know. He said that's the first time people actually think, which is cynical, but unfortunately, possibly true. So there were these songs that formed an integral part of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple service. There are traditions that there were different tunes for different sacrifices. There's a for example, the sin offering. There was a sad, mournful tune played until the moment that the sacrifice, the offering, was accepted, in which case it would segue into a happy tune, right? Nice. Signifying the change in the mood. Here is the sinner is bringing his offering. He's repenting and he's been given atonement. And now it's like going from winter to spring.
Cool.
Vivaldi, Four Seasons, etc. So beautiful. So that there is a tradition to that effect. Also, it is some say that that when King David wrote many of his psalms, he wrote them for the purpose of being sung in the, and some of them were based on choir masters in the temple.
Lamanatsea. I mean, they're first meant to be, there's a conductor for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So written for him or by him, maybe. So there's a lot to be said. And very famously, we find numerous times, this is found in the book of Samuel. It's found in the book of Kings that, and the Talmud makes a point, it says, Vayihi kenagen hamanagen v'nach alav ruach Hashem, that to attain the level of prophetic inspiration, the prophets would sometimes summon musicians to play. So it sounds like from the Talmud, the Gemara and Shabbos, tractate Shabbat, Shabbos, I don't know if I should use Ashkenaz. I'll just be normal, Shabbos, right? Philly's normal for me. I'm not saying that it's not normal.
For somebody from Melbourne, Australia.
Yeah. We're cool. I'm cool with Shabbos, right? Yes. Although most Jews in Melbourne probably say Shabbat, right? But whatever. Anyway, so it sounds like it's to bring happiness, because we know the divine presence rests only when there's happiness, and music can bring that happiness. And it's type of interesting, there was a Reb Meir Ibn Gabai has a book in Avodas HaKodesh, the holy service, a holy worship. And in it, he mentions that it's true that Moses had continuous prophecy. He did not need music for that. He said, but other prophets, they didn't have the ability to elevate themselves to that prophetic level without the assistance of music, and very, very essential. So music, in terms of, it may be that it's just bringing happiness, but it also sounds like, from Rav Meir Ibn Gabai, that it's also elevating the person to a point where they are, where they're connecting to some higher spiritual world.
So you're saying, in other words, it's not just, so let's say somebody was really happy because they heard some good news. That might not be enough for them to get Nevuah. They need music to get
it. It may very well
be. According to him.
Yeah, may very well be correct. Mm-hmm. And one of the most fascinating sources, which again, we have discussed before, is Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov, you know, the Gaon of Vilna, believed that Jews should move to Israel. He actually sent students of his to Israel. They settled in Tzfat, north of Israel. Why he did this is, you know, it's unclear. That's another discussion. Is it to create a framework for the Mashiach, for the messianic framework, Jews in Israel, etc.? I don't know. But he did, he encouraged his students to go to Israel. And one of them was Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov. Anyone who's been to Har Nof will be aware that there is a street there which everyone calls, starts with an M.
All people, don't shout all at once. People, do not shout all at once.
Mishkalov Street. And I would always correct people, it's not Mishkalov Street.
It's M, period.
The street is Reb Yisrael of Shklov. So it's Reb Yisrael Mishklov. Rabbi Yisrael Mishklov, Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov.
Nice.
People looked at me like I was insane, which I'm used to, right? There's like the street names in Israel are just fantastic.
We lived off of, in Neve Yaakov, we lived just below from a street that everybody called Pardes. But the name was after a Rav whose name was Paredes, and my wife's family, that was their name. Their name got changed to Phallus, from her mother's side, but they were this. They're related to this rabbi, but everybody calls it Paredes Street.
Amazing.
Paredes
was where name. My daughter lives in Jerusalem, Givat Ze'ev. A lot of the streets are named after animals. The street next to her is called Ha'ari, which means the lion, and in the sign, it's in English, it says Harry Street, H-A-R-R-Y, Harry Street.
It's like the French, also,
Ha-ari.
Givat Zorfatit. Givat Zorfatit,
yes,
is named after a guy whose last name was French. the guy, it's named after a man whose last name was French.
Amazing.
And okay. They named a whole neighborhood.
From the inventor of fries.
That's it.
Unbelievable. You could get a Nobel Prize just for that.
There you go.
So anyway, Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov, one of the great founders of the Jewish community in Tzfat, certainly one of the pioneers in the increase of Jews in Tzfat in the north of Israel. So he wrote a book called Pa'as HaShulchan, The Corner of the Table. As you know, the Code of Jewish Law written by Rabbi Yosef Karo in Tzfat is called the Shulchan Aruch, the set table. Rabbi Moshe Isserles in Krakow, who wrote Ashkenazi emendations and additions to that table, set table, called his book the Mapa, which means the tablecloth. Table's not set, tablecloth. And Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov called his book Pa'as HaShulchan, the corner of the table, right? Which is also a double entendre, because Pa'ah is one of the mitzvahs, one of the commandments you have to do in Israel. So he called his book Pa'as HaShulchan, which was an addendum to the Code of Jewish Law with the laws of the land of Israel, fully developed by him because they were living there. So one of the most fascinating parts of the book is the introduction, which has got a lot of information about the what the Jews went through in settling Israel and Tzfat, the earthquakes and the plagues and the anti-Semitism and the internecine struggles and the taxation and et cetera, right? Not just middle seat on El Al, but much worse. Is there anything worse? Could be a plague. No.
Actually did sit.
Plague, earthquake.
This last trip. Worse.
Yes.
In a middle seat. This was in November. Middle seat between two Hasidish Bachrim. Who did not go to sleep the whole time. Somehow they got the election. They got Wi-Fi and they're following the election in America, which was going on then. So they're constantly like walking over me back and forth. But I did not care because I knew I had this flight. I was just so grateful to be able to fly to Israel. I did not mind. But I was in the middle seat, two Hasidish Bachrim on either side of me.
Yep.
And it was a joy.
Nothing against Kassim, but yeah.
That, no.
Right, okay. So in those days, it was much more difficult than the middle seat. Plagues, earthquakes, etc. So anyway, aside from that, also, there's a lot of biographical information about Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov's teacher and Rebbe, the Gaon of Vilna. So I'm going to read to you the Hebrew. Koi Omar Hagro. This is what the Gaon of Vilna said. Kol ha-chochmois nitzrochim l'toraseinu ha-kadoisha u'kluim ba'ol. Wisdom is necessary for our Torah and is included in it. The Adam, and in other words, you need to, you can't, not everyone can derive that from the Torah. So in order to understand the Torah, you need to know a lot of earthly secular wisdom. And he says, the Adam kulam tachlisim, and the Gaon of Vilna knew these things well. The Yizkiram, and he mentioned some of them. Chochmas ha-algebra. I don't have to translate that. Mishuloshim, which is geometry. Handasa, which is some type of engineering, although they used to, I think they refer to handasa as really physics.
Okay.
V'chochmas musica, and the wisdom of music. V'shibcha harbei, and he praised that tremendously. So the Gaon of Vilna knew mathematics, and by the way, he had one of his students translate Euclid's geometry into Hebrew. I think the book's called Ayel HaMashulash. One of my roommates in Itri, who is now a Hasidic Rebbe, his name's Reb Moshe Eichenstein.
The Trisker Rebbe.
Yes. I saw him at Manny's in Mount Shaorim about a year and a half ago. So I walked into Manny's, the bookstore in Mount Shaorim, and there's this distinguished-looking Rebbe, who I immediately recognized, with his gabbai, right, standing next to him, his aide-de-camp, whatever you call it. And he recognized me. He says, Mordechai. Right,
why would he not recognize you?
Right, well, I don't know.
Why are you surprised?
I was 18 then.
Yeah, but you
over 40 years ago.
Significant time with him.
40 years ago.
Everybody remember. Have you bumped into one guy that doesn't remember you so far? You were very memorable.
It could be the accent. Maybe it's the accent. Okay.
It was for sure the accent.
So
the accent.
He used to read. He used to read that sometimes before he went to sleep. He'd a few pages of this geometry book in Hebrew and Aramaic, right?
Do you remember Gedalia Ortlacher, a blessed memory?
Yes, yes.
So he, one time I was sitting on a, he lived in Neve Yaakov when I lived in Neve Yaakov, and we'd ride the bus together sometimes. And so I was sitting next to him, and he had what looked like a very old book, like small old book. And I asked him what it was, and he said, it's a poem written in the 1300s. The book's not from the 1300s. It was a poem written in the 1300s that includes all the irregular verbs of Hebrew. And there was also one time where I made a joke, you know, in Kola, we were just sitting together eating like a Mishkanah Torah. And I made a joke. The joke was something like, how is it possible that two people can be dressed identically alike, and then only one of them changes their clothes, and now neither of them are alike? I just made that observation as a joke. The next day, he came, he had something from the Ramchal on logic, that it was written by the Ramchal on logic, and he showed me where this principle was discussed there. There are people like them.
Derech Tfunos. He was a brilliant, yeah.
Do you think it was Derech Tfunos that was the list of his logical premises?
Yeah.
But it looked like just one after another. It looked thinner than that. But you think so. Okay, I'll let you go there. So, I like just the way you say it with your Australian accent.
He had I think his degree was in classical languages.
It was, yes.
And he was a brilliant grammarian, Hebrew grammarian, amongst other things. So anyway, so he had this book, geometry, algebra, physics, and music, which he praised tremendously. Hu haya omer. Now, this is Rabbi Yisrael Shklov quoting the Gaon of Vilna. He used to say, ki rov tame Torah, most of the reasons of the Torah, the sodois shirei halavim, the secrets in the songs of the Levites, the sodois tikunei hazohar, and the secrets of the tikunei zohar. That's a section of the Zohar in which there's, 70 essays on the first few words of the Torah. E efshar leida bil adar, you cannot know any of these things without music, without the knowledge of music. In other words, you cannot understand most of the reasons of the Torah. Interesting. You cannot understand the secrets of the songs of the Levites. That's more understandable. The secrets of the Zohar, the Tikkunei Zohar, you cannot know without knowing music. And I don't understand this, right? Va'al yada, and through it, yecholim kol echad lamut bekalus nafsham min imoseh. Music can cause someone to die because their soul leaving them just because of the joy and the pleasure of that music. The soul elevated and just leave the body. V'yicholim lahachyois meisim besoidoi seha hagnuzim b'toira. And you could revive, resuscitate the dead with the secrets of music, which are mystic in its mystical secrets.
I'm pretty sure Michael Jackson in Thriller, Thriller, especially the music video Thriller,
Havdil,
was bringing that notion.
Yeah,
to fruition. You think he used?
I'm going to appeal to the editors to take that out, just for
you. That's going
to
stay in. It's staying in, no matter what happens. It's
so it's fascinating, and I don't understand this. In other words, but there's something about it, and to some degree, I remember Rav Moshe Shapiro once saying that speech is the language of the intellect. Mathematics is the language of nature, and music is the language of the soul. To Rav Moshe Shapiro said, So to some degree, if that's the language, in the same way as if I have a deep understanding of mathematics, then I can understand a lot of nature and a lot of the world and the how it functions and some of the deeper components of its reality and so on. I think it was when Kitty, what's her name? She wrote a book, The Fire and the Equations. Anyway, she asked Stephen Hawking, what gives the world meaning? And he said, equations. That's the basis of everything. And then she said to him, but what puts the fire into the equations that gives the world its meaning? Why should equations? He did not have an answer to that. She spends a book trying to figure that out. But it is fascinating. So we understand that to some degree. If I had a deep understanding of mathematics, so in the same way, since music is the language of the soul, maybe if we had a deep understanding of music, we could understand a lot about the soul and consequently a lot about the deeper workings of the spiritual world.
Can I just summarize up until now some of the things
Please.
That you've said?
Go ahead.
And maybe in this way, there is a broad topic, which we'll call music, but within the broad topic of music, there is something like the experience of singing. Mm-hmm. The experience of singing can, we know, like when you're at a kumsitz or even sometimes when you're at a celebration, you're dancing, let's say at a wedding, and you're singing, you can sense that there's some kind of higher, there's an elevation of your person to some degree when you're singing. There's also listening to music when you're not singing. And I've had that experience. I remember being in circumstances where also like kumsitzes or places where like friends are playing musical instruments or we're just sitting around and you go to some special higher place. It feels like that just from listening to music. And that might be like Alicia, because Alicia, it doesn't say Alicia was singing. It says he asked for a musician to come and play and be menage for somebody to play the instrument for him. Right. So there's when I'm singing myself, there's listening to music. Then there's something called the wisdom of music, which I could imagine, because partly because I don't fully understand what it means to call to speak of the wisdom of music, I could imagine somebody who somehow through the wisdom of music is understanding something, but you know, because I've seen musicians. My son AY is a singer. He's a wedding singer, and there's something called musical theory, and he'll be talking to somebody else. And they're just talking about music and you can see their faces sort of light up at certain ideas or something like that. That's something, I don't know if that's even in the ballpark of what he means by the wisdom of music. But it's funny to me that, but possible that that doesn't involve singing or listening to music, that there's some kind of wisdom of music that's not like that. And you also mentioned dancing with Miriam and, so I'm sort of interested in, is dancing something different? Is dancing also connected to music? Is it an expression of music?
I mean, it's definitely connected to music. I mean, it's difficult to dance without music. I mean, the body moving to the music is pretty central to music.
So would you call dancing an expression of music? I guess we would, right?
Yeah.
So in this ballpark of expressions, you have singing, you have listening to music, in other words, playing musical instruments or listening to musical instruments, you have dancing, and then you have something called wisdom of music. Am I leaving anything out of the... Also, you, by the way, you mentioned things like Oz Yoshir. Is it clear that that's a song? I mean, because the song and poem, you know, it's not always clear when they use the word Shira. Are they, does it mean there's music, or does, is it possible
that it's just a poem?
That it's a poem?
Well, I say we have a tradition, and the Talmud says that it is actually goes back to Sinai, that the way we sing the Torah when we read it is an essential component of the Torah, of the oral tradition. That gives the punctuation, the emphasis, a lot of the emotion to the Torah. So the Torah itself is sung. And in within that tradition, there's a tradition that the certain song parts of the Torah, like the Song of the Red Sea, the Be'er, are sung in a specific way that is a little different from the rest of the Torah. It's more of a song than a, so that may indicate that it wasn't not merely poetry, but it was an actual song. The Netziv Naftali for Yehuda Berlin, in Hamek Dovar, he says, I think it's on the last mitzvah where the Torah tells us, write down this. The Torah is referred to as a song.
Yeah.
The whole Torah is referred to as Shira Hazois, this song. So he understands, he says, because he says there's such a thing as prose and there's poetry. He says prose usually is just that what it says is what it means. What it means is what it says. He says, when it comes to poetry or song, there's many different dimensions of expression of that. There is, yes, the information in the words, but there's more. There is the drama and the emotion and many different layers. Says, the Torah is called a song because it has within it many ways of communicating, many dimensions of ideas in it. Type of just
interesting. Nice.
That he should say that. That's the Netziv. Apropos of what you were saying, there's also, I think, another component, which is type of the, and this is a somewhat of a mystery, is the neurological impact of music. Like the impact it has on, it is a whole brain type thing, and the impact it has. So I've been interested, I just started looking at this book, which I know it's backwards, but it's called The Music Instinct: How Music Works and Why We Can't Do Without It, by Philip Ball, Oxford University Press. So it's 15 years out of date. So my wife said some of the neurological data is a little out of date, 15 years. But okay, but nevertheless, they have some fascinating quotes here. Darwin in The Descent of Man, as neither the enjoyment nor the capacity of producing musical notes are faculties of the least direct use to man in reference to his ordinary habits of life, they must be ranked amongst the more mysterious with which he is endowed. He says, like, the survival, in terms of survival, food, protection.
What do you need it for?
Music doesn't seem, he says, it's strange. They are present, though in a very rude and, as it appears, almost latent condition in men of all races, even the most savage. I know we're not supposed to use the word savage anymore.
No. But, savage.
But I'm quoting from Darwin. So I think
also, when you use your Australian accent, it sounds fine.
His time, you could say savage, but yeah. So the survival of the fittest, like they have a picture of a bone flute. That's a bone flute. I know it's hard to see that, but which they say is about 40,000 years old. That's in Swabian Jura. Swabian Jura, one of the most beautiful places I've never been. Okay, so there is this music mystery, which people struggle to understand. The why does it have that impact? And it affects us tremendously. There's also fascinating in this book. Again, I don't claim to understand a lot of the book because I don't have enough of an understanding of music. But they point out that it was believed, and I think it's probably true, that Plato, let me make the songs of a nation, wrote Plato, I care not who makes its laws. He felt that the music would impact the people much more than the laws. He felt that there was that music was a moral issue. That it can actually increase pious behavior, noble behavior, or it can actually prompt one to to terrible behavior.
When we were in high school at Brisk Yeshiva in Chicago, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik forbade us to listen to rock and roll music because he believed that it expressed an ethos that was in contradiction to Torah values. And therefore, he felt that we should not listen. He forbade it. We were not allowed to listen to it. I'm not saying what happened in actuality, did people listen to it? I'm just saying it was forbidden to listen to it. We've had this discussion over the past several decades about whether music can itself be tainted by Tuma, and you had a Ramosha related.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember there was a guy at Or Sameach. But before I get there, by the way, I remember we once got a Musar Shmooze. One of the rabbis at Itri was railing against a new singer who had come out at the time. Who was it?
It was either Avram Fried or Mordechai Ben. It wasn't
Mordechai
either
Ben David.
It was Mordechai Ben David.
It was Mordechai Ben David, and he described his music as the beat from the street. The beat from the street. It was like,
I remember Rabiel Schwartz once came in. This is my first year in Itri. Rabiel Schwartz, of blessed memory, walked in the room. We were playing something like Mordechai Ben David or Avram Fried, and he said, Asur, Asur. And I thought he thought it was rock music. That's why he was saying Asur. But he held it was Asur because we were in Yerushalayim, and he held you weren't allowed to play that kind of music.
Remembrance of the temple. Yes, there is a, there is a view. Moshe Feinstein maintains that you should not listen to music, period. Because of Zeichel Churban, remembering the temple. Only at a simcha. Simcha shel mitzvah, only at a celebration which is of a mitzvah, holy celebration, a wedding, etc. Otherwise, you should not listen to music. Instrumental music. Maybe there's some leniencies, but yeah, there is a view like that. But I remember we had a student at Or Sameach many years ago, and he was a classical violinist. And he said he wanted to ask some questions about music to someone senior, someone who really understood. So I said, okay, I'll take you to my teacher, Rav Moshe Shapiro. So we went. It was a Thursday night. He was giving his Thursday night class. Hundreds of people packed into the third floor in Or Sameach. I don't know if you remember that. And I stood with the guy at the entrance. And as Rav Moshe finished, the crowd parts. And Rav Moshe walks down. Right. And this guy is.
And it's not easy to park in there because they are packed
correct.
Body to body.
Right.
But obviously. They parked. They parked.
Miraculous, obviously.
It was Kriya Samson.
Yeah. And this guy was just like, he was blown away just by, he says, my gosh. Yeah. And then Rav Moshe came over and shook his hand and greeted him very warmly. And he was very, very overwhelmed by, this great man, clearly respected by all these hundreds of students. So we sat in the office. And he asked if he could ask a few questions. So he asked Rav Moshe. He said, first of all, I'm a classical musician. He says, is that a trade? Is that a profession that is acceptable? And Rav Moshe said, umnus nekia vakala. It's an expression from the Mishnah. It is a trade which is clean and easy, meaning it's clean of prohibitions. It's easy in the sense it doesn't overtake your entire life. He says, yes, absolutely fantastic. The guy said, what about, he says, can I play music that was originally written for maybe hymns at the church or anything like that? And Rav Moshe says, you can listen and play to Bach and play Bach. Right. And he said, and he followed that statement by saying, music eino mekabel tuma. Music does not become impure, which was interesting. The guy then said, it bothers me, guys are singing and they often sing out of tune. And Rav Moshe said, me too, bothers me as well. Now, this idea that music does not become tame is hotly disputed, as you know. There are all types of discussions. In fact, the Mishnah Brura, the Chafetz Chaim, talks about this, about that it's prohibited to sing songs which have negative components. Now, that may be the words, but it sounds like he's just talking about the tunes. There's also Reb Moshe Feinstein.
As a tshuva about it, right?
Yeah, he said melodies that the Christians sing in their houses of prayer should not be, you're not allowed to listen to them. And he says that's actually prohibited. So it appears that, I guess, Reb Moshe Shapiro held differently.
Yeah.
Not at all clear. There is actually Rav Nachman of Breslov. Rav Nachman of Breslov is Likutei Moharan, the third Torah 3. He says, if you hear music from Mimenagein Rasha, from an evil musician, evil musician, Kashelo La'avoidas Haboire, it is makes service of God difficult.
Just in that moment, or
I don't know. Ukshashomea Mimenagen Kasher Vahagun, when he hears music from a kosher and appropriate singer, it is good for him. Now, here he's not talking about the origin. He's not talking about the origin. He is talking about the person who is
performing it live.
If the person who's singing or performing it is a good person, that will be helpful to you. If the person singing or performing is not a good person, that will hinder your service of God. Type of interesting. And I do know that in Hasidic sources, there is an idea that they claim that the soul of the essence of the person who composed the music is somehow felt in the music and can have an impact on you. On the other hand, a lot of Hasidic music comes from Ukrainian folk tunes and Russian folk tunes.
Yeah, there's no such thing as original Jewish music.
Reb Moshe Shapiro, in that conversation, Reb Moshe Shapiro said he feels that the Jewish music of today, he says classical music, Beethoven, Bach, Vivaldi, etc., is probably closer to the music of the Beis Hamikdash, the Holy Temple, than modern-day Jewish music. Because when you think about modern-day Jewish music, much of it is Eastern, a lot of it is Eastern European, some of it is Arabic influence, etc. It's very much klezmer is a mixture of a number of different streams of music. I like it, but is it authentic Jewish music? I don't know.
Off the top of your head,
yeah.
Name a song that you love.
Rav Shlomo Karlobas Mimkomcha, his tune for Mimkomcha Malkeinu Sophia.
How does it go?
Oh boy, you're putting me on the spot here. Mimkomcha, I Malkeinu Sophia.
Nice.
That's a beautiful. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yes, Dvekastik, very Dvekastik.
A lot of his songs are like that. And type of interesting, Rav Kolonimus Kalman Shapira, the Piasetzna Rebbe, famous for his being in the ghetto
teaching
killed during the Second World War.
Yeah.
And a lot of what he wrote, one of the things he writes is a person has to make ladders to elevate him, to climb up them to the heavens. He says nigun, music, is one of the ladders that you can use to climb up to the heavens. It will be frat, especially meranim achas simcha shel mitzvah, when we sing after a simcha, a happiness of celebrating a mitzvah, ubelev nishbar, with a broken heart. Interesting, Nate. Yeah. So there's a lot of the Mittler Rebbe, who was the Lubavitcher Rebbe of Dov Ber Schneerson, has something called Kuntra Sahispalus, which is the pamphlet on inspiration. And one of the things he talks about is the power of music to inspire. and to lift oneself up to a level where, how does he put it, where his free will is elevated to a point where it's almost completely good. Again, these are things which are difficult to understand, but that's the power of music there.
I remember one time, it was Gershon Zeffrin's, a blessed memory, his Sheva Brochas.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a Sheva. No, it might have been a Vort. I don't remember. No, it was a. I don't remember if it was a Vort or a Sheva Brochas, but it was at his. And so, his wife Donna was from Sharfman's. And so there were some people from the staff at Sharfman's were there, and Ramosha was there. And so somebody from Sharfman's, I think I know it was, but I'm not sure. He spoke and he quoted the Maharal. He was like all about the Maharal. And then it was time for Ramosha to speak. And instead of speaking, he sang. He started the song, Ko Amar Hashem, Zacharti Lachesed Nuraich. And we just sang. Ramosha never spoke. He just sang. And we considered it ironic because Sharfman's,
the singer.
Rabbi Label Sharfman was the singer.
Yes, absolutely.
And Ramosha is the Maharal. And yet, at that moment, the tables were turned. But he sang that song, which is a beautiful song too, Ko Amar Hashem, Zacharti Lachesed
Nuraich. Amazing.
That's beautiful. I remember one time there was some band years ago. It was French. I think it was called Rea Mehimna. And
sounds familiar.
Yeah. So this is really like a long time ago. And I was schmoozing with Rabbi Tursky, Reb Michal Tursky. By definition, if I just plain say Rabbi Tursky, it's always Rabbi Michal Tursky. He should live long and in good health. So I was talking to him and I told him that there's this band called Rea Mehimna, and he goes like, what is it? Somehow I got a hold of a copy of it. In those days, it must've been a cassette tape.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a song. I just played him this song. It starts off, he was a holy man. Da, 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 da. He was a holy man. Da, 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 da. Baal Shem Tov was the name he had. And he just stared at me. It was one of the most precious shared moments in music I've had with anybody, because there was a moment, a heartfelt connection over those lyrics and that tune at that moment.
I remember one of Ramosha's favorite songs was V'yimaleh mishaloseinu, V'yimaleh mishaloseinu. He used to sing that. We sang that for a long time. There was a story which Rabbi Nissel tells in his book, Looking into the Sun. That was our I think it was our second year at Mishkan HaTorah, and it was before Purim, and we wanted to do a Purim spiel. The previous year's Purim spiel was...
he wasn't there yet.
To say the least... somewhat biting, a little bit. Some people were offended. Anyway, so we asked Reb Moshe if we could do a Purim spiel. He said, I cannot tell you if it's osser or mutter, but one thing I can say is if you don't do it, I guarantee you a chelek in Olam Haba, a place in the world to come. So we decided not to. And instead, we had a kumsitz and he sang. He spoke and he sang, and it was definitely better than a Purim spiel, I think.
And nobody, there was one guy that was drunk, but other than that, it was also like, it was a very high moment. It was very high.
Transported.
Yeah.
And there, I'd like to continue this music thing, maybe next one as well.
Okay.
But we have to stop now but maybe we should get friends of ours who are musicians to speak about this. I can think of
two.
I'm not going to mention their names yet.
Okay, Barry, amongst
them. And but it's been great to speak to you again. And folks, if you like this podcast, how should they express that? I guess just do a like.
I think they should sing. They should sing a song. and possibly dance.
Tell people about it. Tell people.
No. Just sing and dance. That's all we want from you.
No, don't.
We want nothing more.
Okay.
Than your joy and expression and possible understanding of the deep mysteries of the Torah.
We'll have to agree to disagree on this, but okay.
All right.
Kol Tov, good to see you.
Kol Tov.
Everyone for watching, listening, and singing and dancing. And we will see you next week.
Okay. Be well.